this with a question, so, and then we'll take some questions here for the few minutes we have. But I thought I had a little obligation here to just give some data on New York, get a little comparative statistics here. We have in this city public housing, which is about 180,000 units, houses about 400,000 people, and that's about, the percent here, about 5% of the population, and that is very low income, basically. We also have the federal government that provides for lower income people vouchers so that they, in renting, don't have to pay more than 30% of their income in order to rent. And the federal government provides some other subsidies, something called a low-income housing tax credit. And we have, because of our tax system, an incredible large subsidy, mainly to upper-income people for housing by allowing them to deduct the cost of their interest that they have if they have a mortgage. But in addition to all of that, there is the New York City Housing Department. As Carol mentioned, that is, I was deputy commissioner there. I'll talk very briefly more about that. By and large, the housing department does not own any housing, but does provide subsidies to the private sector to make the housing affordable. In the original 10-year plan, the housing plan in 1986, we rebuilt all of the city's neighborhoods, many of which had deteriorated extensively. Without war or anything else, we had neighborhoods that did look like that. All of those neighborhoods today, or at least yesterday, I don't know about today, we're doing quite well. And we're predicting the city's population will increase by a million by 2030. So one of the big issues here is how you're going to accommodate that increase in population. The city currently has a 10-year plan of $7.5 billion in government subsidy to subsidize 165,000 units. Those will be rent, a mixture of rental and home ownership, new rehab and preservation. One big issue now is that 30, 40 years ago, there was a significant amount of housing here built with government subsidy, built by the private sector, and it is at the end of their restricted period. And the question is whether the government should provide new subsidies and try and keep those units affordable. The city also has an extensive rent regulation system here that limits the amount, the rate at which rents can go up until they exceed $2,000 a month, and then above that they are deregulated. And we also have, and you'll hear more from the planning commissioner and others, I'm sure, some zoning approaches here, a lot more interest in promoting mixed income through something called inclusionary zoning, where you get bonuses, FAR bonuses, and city subsidies if you I do provide 20-30% of the housing for low income. So we have a wide range of programs to try and promote housing, the development of it, and the development for a full range of incomes. I think everybody here would agree that we struggle a lot about how we're going to keep housing affordable to the middle income. There's many projects that were built for that purpose and now have more recently have been moving up the income stream. So since we haven't solved the problem, I thought the one question I would ask here is, you talked about the difficulties of getting the private sector to provide what we'll call middle-income housing here. So I guess it's above the public housing sector income strata that that serves, but below upper-middle or luxury housing. And that what was happening is, in order for the private sector to do that, they were decreasing the size of the units and maybe even stretching the price that the middle-income people. So I did notice that there was the subsidized program we had before for middle-income had been terminated. I'm wondering, give us a little flavor about why that was done and whether there are any ideas now to combat the trend that you see.
Thank you. The reason you're right, the Housing Authority had this major program to produce units for subsidized sale. The reason that it was brought to an end was that in 1997, we experienced a major correction in property values. We had a very, very serious bubbles, very crudely, and values came down 70%, 70% in 6 months. Which, as you can imagine,
that was house prices, land prices?
House prices, well, yes, house and land. So that was a very, very serious shock to the system. And half the population found themselves in negative equity. So that, again, was a major issue for government and the community to handle. But what it meant was that the repriced units, if you like, based on that 70% correction, the developer could produce units at, or indeed cheaper, than government because of the correction. So government backed out, was pressurized to back out of the production process. Reality is that although the authority was a very efficient authority, they couldn't compete with the private sector at those price levels. The private sector could do a better job in terms of quality, in terms of delivery, so that the authority was persuaded to stop building units for sale on a subsidy basis. More recently, we have seen this issue of affordability crop up again. Although in Hong Kong, the way we measure affordability is 15-year mortgage, 70% mortgage, 70 square meter unit. The level of affordability in Hong Kong is still deemed to be, today is still deemed to be acceptable. It's about 37% of the family income is paid by way of mortgage. But there is a growing some pressure for government to kind of get back into the market and to produce units which will be more affordable than anything the developers can produce. But there's not the pressure there that was in the lead up to 97. In the lead up to 97, affordability went above 100%. So people were paying more, if you like, than their family income to pay the mortgage.
All right. Perhaps we can open up to questions. Shall we do that ourselves then?
Go ahead.
I guess we have microphones on both sides here, so if people want to get in line or whatever.
My name is Alice LaBrie, and I came here especially today because of the subject. I would just like to say that I live in Harlem in what's called Esplanade Gardens. We are one of the few remaining Mitchell-Rama projects left in the city. Mark can explain what that is. We are built on the Harlem River, and we are built over the air rights of the MTA number 3 terminus. Those rights were purchased for $1 in 1967. And of course, as you can appreciate, the value of our middle-income co-op is risen considerably. It is said that we're remaining middle-income, Mitchell-Rama, because we are a huge voting bloc that the politicians would like to keep as a unit. We are 26-story buildings. And with Carol's permission, if you have time while you're in town, I would very much have to come and have a look at it. So that being said, I will now go on. I was wondering if you could sort of quote some of the prices of the subsidized housing, and are you experiencing any social problems like crime, things like that?
As I said in my remarks, the Hong Kong people are largely very pragmatic, and to date we have not had the sort of social problems that have been experienced, if you like, in many Western countries in terms of high-rise living. That said, there is in some of the new towns, which, if you like, were built when Hong Kong was in growth mode and didn't have necessarily the planning and the thought given to them they should have done. We are experiencing some pressures there, particularly in terms of suicide, which is very unfortunate. A lot of family feuds, suicides, the sort of things that build up, if you like, from the pressure of living in a high-rise tower. So it is an issue in some cases. In terms of rents, and you have to, again, this is where you have to think in terms of the Hong Kong context, a family renting a public sector rental unit would probably pay about $200 a month. $200 a month. Now that, as I said, is one tenth, if you like, of what they'd be paying if they were in the private sector. So the element of subsidy is huge. And the great challenge for the community of Hong Kong is, what do we do with these 700,000 units? We've tried to sell them to the sitting tenants, And that was fine when you were selling modern flats. Then there was a market, if you like, and the tenants could be persuaded to take them. But when you're selling, or you're trying to persuade a tenant to buy something which is 30 or 40 years old, in the Hong Kong context, it is very difficult. And really, and government is struggling as to how, where and how it'll go, if you like, or what it should do with these 700,000 units. Because there are, clearly there's a replacement and a redevelopment liability on the community, 700,000 units over time. It's a huge bill, a huge liability. And I have seen the calculations and examination of the problem done, which demonstrate that, in fact, it would pay the government to actually give these units to the individual owners. It would be cheaper in the long run to give the units to the individual owners rather than continue to have the liability for 700,000 homes.
Just a quick observation here, I think you may be interested, but at least for America, public housing in New York works particularly well, has relatively low crime rates, and it is high rise. So the idea that high rise in and of itself doesn't work, which I think many people have, is really been disproved here.
Yeah, yeah.
Question?
My voice is definitely So I'm sorry if I'm repeating anything because I really just arrived, but the first question I really have about Hong Kong, especially as compared to New York, is what is the land use and the zoning process like there at all? Because seeing that kind of density, I think like one of the continuing reasons why New York has had such problems delivering on middle-income housing, especially as compared to the rest of the United States, is simply that we, you know, don't have the land, and therefore we would have to go vertical in order for developers to be able to supply that number of units. Sean Donovan, he once told me that we would need 250,000 units of market-rate housing to begin to see the actual price levels come down. So we're always in this, a very low vacancy rate, which of course creates an enormous supply, a price pressure. Whereas it seems like Hong Kong is managing to supply the demand better. We have this very complex and really important land use process, but that often winds up reducing densities. A lot of down zonings throughout most neighborhoods in New York, and even in the areas where there's been up zonings, it's always compromised slightly, by community activism, for better or worse, and certainly many community planning principles which are being advocated and are, and therefore you could argue the quality of the development.
That's a great question, but if I may, before Nick answers, we should separate out the cost of land from the issue of whether density, vertical density works, because quite honestly, if the land only costs a dollar and you can build 100 on it, it only costs 50 cents, 10 cents actually, whatever, I messed up the math, $1, right, in land value, land costs for each unit. So in fact, density can actually be built more cheaply, depending on how expensive the structure is itself, but you can spread the land cost over many more units. But let's ask the more basic question you did about zoning.
Well, we have two base documents which control density in Hong Kong. One is the lease, and that, as I said, is granted by government. They are interested in maximizing revenue, so they will grant the highest density they feel is that they can get away with, if I'm going to put it that way, or that they think is acceptable. In return for being paid a premium. So the government is keen to see density because that produces higher land revenue. So within that document, you will be allowed to build, for instance, residential can be up to 10 FAR, 10 times site area, and government often will allow that to happen because they have, as I said, they're keen to maximize land revenues. So that's one controlling document. The second is the zoning plan, which overlays the whole of Hong Kong. You've got zoning plans. which basically lay down the use and the height and the site coverage and things like that pertinent to that particular site. So those are the two controlling documents. But what really drives the density and the height is the wish of government to maximize land revenue.
Okay, I think we've reached the end of our time, so thank you, Karen.